Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and it's great to have you with us wherever you're listening from. Our Book Off tote bags are selling like hotcakes, ladies and gentlemen, and thanks to everyone who's bought one already. We still have some left, so if you fancy pimping up your book buying, then you can find the link to buy one of our bags on our social channels. And enough of the hard sell, down to business. It's time to welcome our authors for this episode. And my first guest is a poet, author and former lawyer, a semi-finalist for the Fulbright Fellowship and has written for many publications, including Minerva Rising, Women Arts Quarterly and Jet Fuel Review. Having lived in Okinawa, Ghana, Chicago, Cuba, Spain, Italy, Washington, D.C., she has moved back to her hometown of Memphis, where she sits on her porch most evenings listening to records. And that sounds like bliss. I'm hoping to get an invite. Here to tell us about her debut novel, Memphis, it's Tara M. Stringfellow. Hello to you.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
What an absolute pleasure to have you here and in the studio as well, Tara. Thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you. I just want to say your voice is amazing. I'm like blown away. Like, wow.
And my second guest is the author of three novels, which include the New York Times bestseller Wench. She is a 2020 nominee for a United States Artist Fellowship and the current chair of the board of the Penn Faulkner Foundation. On behalf of the foundation, she has visited nearly every public high school in the District of Columbia to talk about the importance of reading and writing, and she's here to tell us about her third novel, her first to be published here in the UK. It's Dolan Perkins Valdez. Welcome to you, Dolan.
Thank you.
And I should introduce you because Tara is here in the studio with me in London. Dolan, you're all the way over there in Washington, D.C. Tara, Dolan, Dolan, Tara. Intro's done.
How is
Washington this morning?
Well, it's still dark outside. But we've had very good weather, so that's good. Yesterday it was about 65 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's been nice. Mm.
And thank you so much for getting up so early to speak to us today. We really appreciate it.
I'm usually a morning person, but this morning I just struggled, so I'm just glad to not have missed my alarm.
No, we are too. And Tara, it's wonderful to have you in London and here in the UK. Memphis holds a special place in my heart because as a music lover, Some of my favourite records were recorded there. Some of my favourite artists are from
there.
And I had the absolute privilege and pleasure a few years ago, well, about 5 years ago now, of recording at Sun Studios as well.
No.
Yeah. And
really?
It's just ever since that trip.
Yeah.
It's held a bit of a place in my heart. So.
Aww, I'm so glad. I love when folk tell me that they love Memphis, my city. It makes me feel real good. Like, oh, we did good.
And is the sort of back porch listening to records really true?
Yeah. My dad, for my last birthday, the birthday before, got me a little portable one. I have I have a Victrola, like in the book. Mm. I have like a little parlor, and that's my music room when you first walk in. But I have a huge front porch, and me and my hound. I have a Tennessee Walker hound named Huckleberry. And you can find us on the porch sitting and listening to Al Green or Aretha. You know, and then I'll make myself a drink. And I'm out in a kimono. All my neighbors come by. I'm like in
this
a row.
This is a dream.
Yelling at folk in the street. They're like, hey, when that book coming out, though? You going to London? Oh, it's going to be, well, what you going to say? It's going to be cold over there. Just, okay, well, we'll get back. Well, where's Huck going to be when you're in London? That's all they care. Where's Huck? Where is
Huckleberry? About the dog. You got to look after the dog.
He's more famous than I'll ever be. He's very attractive too.
Oh,
he's,
that's wonderful.
He's more gorgeous and more popular than I'll ever be in my entire life, and I'm fine with that.
You paint such a lovely picture. And we're going to talk about Memphis, of course, a lot, and this new book. In fact, both of your books over the next half an hour or so, as well as finding out some reading recommendations from you. And of course, we will do the book off, where each of you gets 3 minutes to tell us about a book you love and you think that we should all read. Tara, at the front of my copy of Memphis is a note from you, and it's about why you decided to write this book. And it feels like it came actually from a sort of place of anger. You know, you said that you knew the title before anything else. Could you just tell us what was in that author note?
It was 2016. It was November. It was my birthday. My birthday's November 6th. And it asked for two things from God for my birthday. I asked for the Cubs to win the World Series. They did the week before. And I asked for Hill to win the election, and she did not. I think I was greedy, and it was all my fault, so I felt really bad for my country and for everyone. Like, I literally thought I had some sort of hand in this, and I was just really sick of any racist, but especially a racist demagogue, to get up there and tell me who made this country great when I knew damn well it was me and mine and every other Black family out there, or any brown family, any immigrant family, making this country great. And I just knew I had to write Memphis. And as I was writing Memphis, he was calling Baltimore a shit city, you know, another beautiful Black artistic city on the water, you know. And I was just, yeah, I was angry, and I knew my anger could not contain a single poem. So I switched from poetry to prose, and I just had more to say. I wanted to write, I think of my book, Memphis, as a long epic poem to my city. So even though it is a book, a novel, I consider it my second poetry collection in a way.
Yeah, that's nice. Because, of course, your poetry will have informed this writing, you know,
right.
without your background of poetry, this book might not have been.
It could have never been.
So how did you find the writing of prose versus, you know, what you had written before?
So I was at Northwestern getting my MFA at night in creative writing, in poetry. I went there for the poetry track, and I wrote a poem entitled Origins. And I remember my professor there that night, Reginald Gibbons, he pushed it, you know, back to me all, you know, because there was a big table and students around, and we all mark it up. You read it out loud and you can't say anything after, and they mark it all up and they push all the papers back to you all with the red ink all over it. And I got all my papers back, and when he pushed them back to me on this long wooden table, he said, this shit should be a novel.
Really?
And I was like, okay. And Trump had just won the election, you know. Yeah, I was going to school at night, and I said, okay. So I went back home that Christmas. I went back home to Memphis. And I sat down at my mom's kitchen table at the bar, and she's like, what are you doing? Why are you up so early? You know, and she came around and she saw that what I was writing. I just said, Memphis. And I said, I think it's time. I write, or I try to, before I die, try to write a great American novel and to let this world know that a Black woman could do that. So that's what I tried to do.
You did.
I don't know. I'm blushing. Y'all can't see, but I'm blushing. I'm underneath the table right now. I'm hiding my face.
Well, yes, you can just stay there and you know, compose yourself, because we'll come back and I want to just talk about the women in Memphis and the story behind it in a moment. But Dolan, if I could just come to you, and Take My Hand is your third novel, as I said, but it's the first novel that is being published here in the UK, which we're very excited about. And this is inspired by a true story, isn't it? Could you just tell us where this idea came from?
So I had heard about the hundreds of thousands of women in the U.S. who had been sterilized by the U.S. government, primarily Black women, but mostly women of color as well, other women of color. And I thought it had been written about because it wasn't a secret history. You know, I'd heard about it. And every now and then, when I was watching a documentary or something, there would flash the image of these two young girls who had been sterilized during that time in the early 1970s. But it was always very brief. It was always sort of like a footnote. And for me, this has been sort of an open secret of American history for the last 50 years. But nobody had written about it. And when I began to just do a little bit of exploring and researching, I learned how big of a deal it was in 1973 in Montgomery, Alabama, when two young sisters were sterilized without the consent of their parents. And I knew that I had to write about it. I was outraged. I was heartbroken as a mother, as a person from the South, a proud daughter of the South. And my mother was a nurse. I was thinking about who was responsible for this at the local level, right? I knew the federal government funded the clinic, but who were the people at the clinic who carry out this horrible tragedy? And I just wanted to write about it, and I couldn't shake it from my mind until I did.
Both of these books are brilliant, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading them, if that's the word. But they're also both very important books, I think. They both have important subject matters, and they deal with really important issues. And I think both of you have tackled them, if I may say so, and be so bold, so well, because you've both created brilliant pieces of fiction that are entertaining, but that also make us think and that have a really true message. And for the listeners, perhaps you could just set up both of your stories for us. Dolan, perhaps just because you've talked about the research and the inspiration behind this, could you just sort of set up the story of Take My Hand for the listeners?
Sure. So my main character is Sybil Townsend, and the story opens in the present. She is a doctor, and her daughter has just graduated college, and she has never told her the story of what happened in 1973 in Montgomery. And she begins by calling her daughter into the house so that she can share this story with her. In 1973, Sybil was a recent graduate of the Tuskegee Nursing School in Tuskegee, Alabama, and her very first job was at this family planning clinic. She has these two young patients, India and Erica, who are 11 and 13 years old and are on birth control. Once she finds out that one of the girls is not even menstruating yet, she also discovers that neither one of them has ever even kissed a boy. She begins to ask questions about why they've been put on birth control. And one thing leads to another until this terrible tragedy occurs, and Sybil finds herself fighting for justice for these two girls. And that fight for justice goes all the way to the highest levels of the U.S. government.
Hmm. And Sybil is such a great character. I think a character that readers will remember for a long time after reading this book, because she's bold, she's outspoken, she's compassionate. And I think, reading it, you know, now, she's a very timely character with all that's going on in the world. And I think that, you know, she is doing what so many people are doing at the moment, and that is, you know, speaking out and being bold and putting themselves on the line a bit, you know?
Yes, I really wanted to create a character who understands that, you know, we can right a wrong, but who also has been somewhat complicit in that system, right? She's not completely guilt-free. She works for the clinic, and even though she fights for the girls, she is a part of the system that is treating poor Black women in a way that is patronizing. And so she has to check herself. And I was really, my protagonists are always, in some ways, extensions of me. And so part of what I'm exploring is, how did this go so horribly wrong? And how does it go from us trying to do a good deed to us having made a tragic error in judgment? And I'm hoping that readers will respond to the complexity of that, because we've all been there where we thought we were doing the right thing, but then we learned that it was much more complicated than that, and that we really needed to examine not only our intentions, but also the results of our good deeds. So I feel like Sybil is a complicated character, but she's a lot like all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tara, you have a cast of characters in Memphis. Perhaps you could introduce us to those and set up the story.
All right, Well, Memphis, like Dolan was saying, the characters are probably extensions of myself. They're probably just like my id, super ego, and ego, like floating around. Memphis is a story. It's a Bildungs Roman. You know, I wanted to write a Southern coming of age novel. I wanted to write a long epic love letter to my city, to the Black women living there in it. I don't want to give too much plot away.
No, don't.
And
don't,
as a poet, I don't care about plot. Maybe I shouldn't say that out loud, but I don't, I don't read a book for plot. You know, that's what I get my movies for, or Euphoria. Okay. You know, I read my novels for the lovely language. Mm-hmm. I know that's very nerdy, but as a poet, I do, for the lyrical nature of it. So I don't want to give too much away, but I have a character named Joan, and she's 10 years old when she arrives in Memphis with her little sister and her mother. They flee a bad situation, and they arrive in Joan's ancestral home. Literally, the city and then the home itself is her ancestral home. Her grandfather built it for her grandmother. And I don't know, she's an artist. She's very feisty. I feel like she has guardian angels around her, like her auntie August, her sister Maya, Miss Jade, Miss Dawn. I'm not going to give anything. I'm not going to tell. I don't want to tell. I don't want to tell. Y'all have to read. Y'all got to do some work. Read my book.
Dolan's smiling and laughing along there because she knows. She knows.
Yeah,
don't give too much away.
Don't give. I can't. I don't know. Things happen.
Well, let me ask you this then. No, things do happen.
Things happen.
And that's, you know, that's a good way
to get around it. Hey, Tara, rub your book. Things happen. Read it. No one's going to read it.
Stick that on the cover. You said like some of those characters, and indeed, you know, some of Memphis, the book is based on your own family history and you.
Yeah.
How did you approach getting that balance right then? So it wasn't just all your story or all your family, and that some of it was fiction and you were just using elements.
So what's the question?
How did you, because a lot of authors put themselves into their books, but how do you balance it, or how did you balance it for Memphis so that you got a bit of you and family?
I feel like all the women are shades of me.
Okay.
Like Joan, I put in how driven I am about poetry, how nerdy.
Yeah.
Like, she's that nerdy and driven about her art. I put that in. How inappropriate and insane Maya is. I'm like that, as y'all have figured out. I am like that. How sassy Auntie August is. Mm-hmm. And you know, she doesn't give a fuck, you know, and how hardworking Miriam is. I think I'm like that. Her dating life is shit, and so is mine. Like, so I feel like these women are all shades of me. And I got to, sometimes when I didn't know what would come next, even in dialogue, I would just go in the shower and think about, like, well, what would I say in that situation if I was a little tipsy, or if I had a little bit more agency in my life, or if I had a home built for me, like, what would I have said in that situation? And even the lovely parts of the book, the falling in love, I've always wanted a man to approach me at a record store or a deli. Like, why is that so goddamn hard? Why did I have to make that into a book? So, I mean,
what's the dream? You both reach for the same record? Is that the sort of movie moment?
It's like we're both fighting over Ma Rainey or Bessie Smith. We're fighting, you know, or some like unreleased Amy Winehouse I haven't seen. Actually, her Frankie, I think, is like $400 for the record. So, yeah, if there's one of those, I'm going to be fighting them.
Hey, I've got an original Frank vinyl.
Stop.
Yeah, I've got a first pressing. I think it's worth
it. It's worth
hundreds of pounds. Yeah, I haven't. Yeah, I keep that one very.
And then music, the music I put in the book, those are my favorite songs and what I listen to. So I feel as if, I don't know, almost every sentence has a little bit of me in it. It's I think every author does that too. If they say they're not, they're lying, I think.
But yes, I agree, and also I think it's also interesting that this book is a fiction book, and as you said, you see it as a sort of like your second poetry collection almost.
Yeah.
But there is potentially an argument from a publishing side that it could have been a memoir or it could have been something non-fiction, but I guess that was never...
My agent emailed me and she said, should this be a memoir? I wrote her back. I'm like, I'm not going to have Oprah sit me on her couch and curse me out talking about a little million things. And this is not a memoir. You made this up. Your granddad. Because I did, you know, my grandparents, unfortunately, all of them have passed.
Mm.
So I made up huge swaths of the book. You know, doing research, I did find out that my actual grandfather was a World War II hero, was stationed on the Western Front fighting. But, you know, I couldn't ask him about that. And in real life, you know, my grandfather was in the Army. In the book, he's a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the book, I wanted the Marine Corps to kind of just be the fluid thing. It would be so confusing to go back from Army to Marine Corps. And then in real life, my father is a Marine. What day is it? He's at the Pentagon now, probably.
Yeah.
We're about to go. So I just wanted to have those real / factual, you know, elements tied in. But I did not want people suing me.
Like
this never happened.
Always the lawyer.
Yeah. The lawyer me. I said, I'm not going to have Oprah mad at me.
And you mentioned research there, Tara, in terms of putting this book together. And Dolan, this book that you've written has so much in it, and you can take so much away as a reader from it because of the subjects you cover. But it's obviously been impeccably researched, and I just wondered how long you spent on this, because you can tell from the story and from the detail that you've really got into this subject.
Well, this one took me 7 years. I hope that books don't take me that long in the future. I do think that I was telling some people last night, Tara mentioned our previous president, whose name I won't mention on this show, but I do think that slowed me down because it was very difficult to think during those 4 years in our country.
And in this country, there was a definite fug in this country, because we were getting the news, and we were sort of, well, I was, and I know a lot of my friends were, we were really consuming it. I think it was slowing us down a bit as well. Sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to say, you know,
it did. It slowed the world down.
Yeah.
And imagine me living in the District of Columbia,
you
know, 10 minutes away from the White House. It was very difficult to shut it out long enough to think. So that slowed me down for sure. Now I'm glad actually that it slowed me down, because I wouldn't have wanted to have a book come out in those years. It was so difficult to have a book come out during those years. But I actually was just talking to a friend yesterday who was an early reader of my draft, and she hasn't read it since I finished it. And I told her, I said, it changed a lot since you read it. So another benefit of taking a long time is that I was able to sit with it longer. And I told her, I said, I took 2 years to digest the feedback you gave me, because she gave me really good, thorough, detailed feedback. So that's a good thing. And so I think if it does feel well-researched, it's really just because I was sitting with it for so long and I was able to think it through.
Yeah. And has she been one of your early readers for all of your books?
No, this was the first one that she did. She and I used to work together. Her name is Sarah Bronstein, and she's one of my brilliant writer friends. And we used to work together. And then one day I asked her, I'm always very shy about asking people to read my horrible early drafts. I'm embarrassed and I'm apologetic and I want to buy them things. But she did it, and she spent a lot of time with it. And she gave me such good feedback. One of the things she said that really stuck with me that I didn't realize at the time, we had been talking about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which came to light in 1972, where they had, over the course of 40 years, left hundreds of Black men untreated with syphilis, and they died. And one of the things she said to me in those early days, she said, this is the Tuskegee syphilis experiment for Black women. And I said, what? She said, yes, this is a book about, medical, for lack of a better word, apartheid. Mm. And I said, wow, okay. I had to process that. That took me a couple of years to just process. Yeah. So I think sitting with a book, I hope I don't take that long in the future. I want to be one of those people that gets a book out more often than this. So that's my hope.
Well, it's our hope as well, obviously. But it's also sounds like it was the book, it needed those 7 years, and that's not a bad thing. That's okay. If that's what it takes. And we're so pleased that it's actually coming out now, and it's coming out in the UK as well. So readers in the UK can get to discover you if they haven't already, Dolan. I want to ask you both what you've been reading and enjoying recently, because it's always great to get some recommendations. And I know that I tend to read new books, like both of your brilliant new novels, and then I'm often then going back to read something older that, an author that's been recommended to me that I should have read years and years ago. So what have you been reading and enjoying recently, Tara, that you want to shout about?
Okay, give me a second. I've just started it, and I think the author is British too.
Okay,
I'm preparing for y'all. I'm prepared. I've just started. I'm 25 pages in it, and it's lovely. It's gorgeous. A Passage North.
Okay.
By Anouk Arud Pragasam.
Right.
And he was shortlisted for the Man Booker. Or do y'all just call it the Booker Prize now?
It's the Booker now. Used to be the Man Booker.
It's still the Man Booker, in my opinion. But yeah, he was shortlisted, and he's a young thing, and he can write. Oh my God.
So this has just captured you, is it?
Oh my God, the first paragraph.
Really?
So the first sentence is beautiful. Do I have the book with me? Oh God, I left it in the hotel. It's usually in my purse. And the first sentence, it's a short one. And then the second sentence of the very first paragraph, it's so long. And it's the meter of it. Again, I read for meter, for the lyricism of the words, not in the plot. Okay, yes, things are happening.
Yeah.
Things happen in the book. Okay,
he's
great
from
at plot.
This conversation is that in books, things happen.
Things happen. What is it? Setting. Yeah. Rising action, climax, falling resolution.
There you go.
Though, that's you go. In my book too. But how he writes is just glorious. Mm. And he's new, and I think I'm just obsessed with him and his writing style and also the book. So I recommend.
Fantastic. And what's the title of it again?
A Passage North.
Fantastic.
And I think it's about, I haven't gotten that far, but it's about the 30-year civil war in Sri Lanka.
Hmm.
And he's taking literally a train through the countryside, through war-torn country. I haven't gotten to that part, but I'm just so excited. And I probably won't. I read real slow because I read for the deliciousness of the words.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm still reading The English Patient. I've been reading that since like Thanksgiving.
A page a week.
Honestly, a page at a time. And I'm never going to finish because I can't. It's too beautiful.
Well, it is a beautiful book, isn't it? And it's worth taking your time. That's the thing. Books are worth taking your time over.
Yes.
That is a very good point. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that recommendation. And what about you, Dolan? Have you been reading and enjoying some things recently?
I have. You know, I have an addiction to historical fiction. I just can't get enough of it. I love like learning about the past through fiction. And that's what I read for pleasure. And now I get to read really for my work. So yeah. Recently I read The Magnolia Palace by Fiona Davis. Fiona Davis is this wonderful historical fiction writer who sets books in these historic New York City landmark buildings. And this latest one, which hit the New York Times bestseller list the first week it came out, is set at the Frick Residence, which was a Gilded Age mansion and is now a museum in New York City. And you get these very interesting stories. You learn about the history of the building, but you get these other stories that are just not even, you know, that much related to the building, but that are set in that era and the main characters going in and out, and you get these lovely architectural descriptions. She's just very good at it. I don't know how she pulls it off. And then, of course, I think the biggest read for me in 2021 was The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois by Honoré Fanon Jeffers. I think it's about, or just was published in the UK, I can't remember, but a monster of a novel in terms of length, but I could not hook that book down. It was so beautiful. I know Honoré took a long time to write it. And when I finally read it, I understood why. That is, to me, a great American novel in the tradition of the best of them. She's just a very talented poet and fiction writer. And then I just read something that's not out yet, but which will be a treasured classic for me. It's called Miss Chloe, and it's a memoir of the literary friendship between Toni Morrison, as you know, Toni Morrison's birth name was Chloe, and the writer A.J. Verdell, who is a novelist from the 1980s, who wrote a wonderful 1980s classic novel called The Good Negress, and then never wrote another book. And
wow.
But she and I, she lives in Washington, and she and I became friends. But I never knew that she was Toni Morrison's friend. I never knew that they were, you know, visiting each other and talking to each other. So the book is not only about her own relationship to books and her coming of age as a writer and reader as a young Black girl. She was 20 years younger than Miss Morrison. But she also writes about their friendship and the conversations they had, not just about literature in general, but about even Morrison's work. And she talks really thoughtfully about her experience reading Morrison's book. And also imagine being close enough to Morrison where you could actually give her an honest opinion about her work.
I know, right?
And Morrison actually respected her opinion. So that to me is going to be a treasured classic.
When's that coming out? Do you know?
That's coming out May 11th in the US HarperCollins Amistad.
Fantastic. Gosh, that sounds, yeah, that really does sound wonderful. Mm-hmm. I'd love to read that, because also I saw recently that some of Toni Morrison's books have been reprinted and jacketed in these beautiful jackets with new forewords. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also a new, I think I'm right in saying that, or a sort of previously unreleased collection that's come out.
Yeah, I think so. And I was just in contact with Toni Morrison's estate for the license for the UK edition for the book, because I used just a very small, I think it's only like 400 words. No, 240 words.
It's not even
words.
That, probably, yeah.
It's 240
words. It's 200
words,
you know
exactly.
It is, yeah.
just to as a dedication and an intro for my book, so yeah. And I've met Miss Morrison twice.
Oh, wow.
Before, before she passed.
So. Yes, when I first met her, it was right after Wench had come out, and someone introduced me to her, and she had read the book, and I couldn't believe it. And she says, "You're the author of Wench?" And I said, "Yes." And she pulled me down close to her, and she whispered in my ear, "You little devil." And I think she was just, she thought the word and the title Wench was hilarious to her, because that's a word of her generation. And when I read A.J. Verdell's memoir, that was one of the things Verdell commented on, that she loved those kinds of old words and that they giggled over them a lot. So, yeah, I'll never forget that. I didn't know at the time, though, when she pulled me down, I thought, what did I do? But she was just joking.
That's amazing that you've both met her. Mm-hmm. And do you think your first two books might be published over here at some point, Dolan, or is that a question I shouldn't ask at the moment?
From your lips to God's ears.
Ooh, I like that.
I hope so.
Yes. I hope so too.
That would be nice. Okay, but no actual plans in the works yet. Let's wait and see. Let's wait.
Not that I know of. No.
Okay.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, I loved all of those recommendations. Thank you very much. And now it's time for another recommendation from each of you, because it's time for the book off. This is where you're each going to tell us about a book that you love and that you think that me and all the listeners should read. You get 3 minutes to do so. You don't have to use all of your 3 minutes if you don't want to. But if you're still talking as the 3 minute mark, I'll either be ringing you out with the school bell or honking you out with the horn. Now, because you're travelling the furthest, Dolan, down the wires from Washington, D.C., you get to decide if you go first or second. Which would you like to do?
I'll go second. I'm so afraid I'm going to get a gong, though, because I didn't time myself. But go ahead.
Don't you worry about that. That's all right. Many, many people have gone before you and got a gong. It's all right. That's an okay thing. So you're gonna sit back and see what Tara's got. Well, Tara, what would you prefer then at the 3 minute mark? Do you want the bell or do you want the horn?
Bell.
Okay. That was a very quick decision.
Yes,
you knew exactly what you wanted.
I've been looking at it on the table and I've been trying not to just take it and shake it. Yes, I want the bell. Please.
It's very tempting, isn't it? Before we start the timer then, just tell us the book that you are putting forward.
Okay, so the title is Oh, You Thought This Was a Date? Apocalypse Poems by my best friend, C. Russell Price, out of Chicago. Northwestern University Press, my alma mater, is publishing it. And it comes out June, I'm not sure which day, but June
this year, though.
This is a new, fresh
book.
This is this June. So right. Please pre-order it. I think you can pre-order it from Northwestern University Press right now.
Okay. And I mean, title alone, it's already out there as a potential winner.
Yes.
Okay, well, I've put 3 minutes on the clock, so it's over to you, uninterrupted, to tell us about Oh, You Thought This Was a Date.
Yes, so Oh, You Thought This Was a Date by C. Russell Price. I mean,
we're the best of friends. We always talk to each other, text each other, and we say, I love you. And then they write back, I love you too. And I write back, and I hate everyone else. And they say, and I hate everyone else too. And I feel as if a book should be written about our friendship. You know, we're two poets out of Chicago, poor, chain smoking together, writing in apartments filled with mice and the love of each other. And I have a small poem to recite from the collection. They gave me permission to do this, C. Russell. And the title alone, the title of this poem is The Devil Rules This World Because He Created It and That God Is Far Away. You would think we'd be ashamed for outliving our friends and fellow Americans. We're not. Our nationalist faith is so strong, it makes everyone uncomfortable. A hummingbird is sobbing during office hours. They're coming to take the hummingbird's family. It is a felony to house a hummingbird. Who even reports a hummingbird? Clearly, I mean a human when I say a hummingbird. It is a sin to make a bird a metaphor for a person. The young woman is sobbing during office hours. They're coming to take the young woman's family. It is a felony to house the young woman. Who even reports a young woman? Clearly, I mean a human when I say a human.
Wow.
They can write when I tell you we'd sit in Chicago apartments, poor, like not a penny to our names, struggling to find the money for a dollar taco, a cigarette, and a shot of Jack. We wrote, and I wrote my Memphis, and C. Russell wrote this collection. So I encourage the world to go out and buy this in June.
Fantastic. Bit of bell, even though you didn't need it, you were well in time there.
Oh, really?
Well in time, Tara.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Goodness me, that was fab. Thank you. And what a...
Oh, can't they write?
What a reading. They certainly Ooh. Can. We'll come back and talk about that in just a moment.
Okay.
You can have a breather now. You can get back to that coffee because it's time
now
for
Now I need a drink.
Step up. Yeah, now we need a...
I need a real drink.
Well, it's nearly midday. I think we can almost do it, you know. Dolan, it's over to you now. I'm putting 3 minutes back on the clock. And just before we start... Why don't you tell us the book that you're putting forward?
So my book is Octavia Butler's Kindred.
Fantastic. 3 minutes on the clock then, uninterrupted if you want it, to tell us about Kindred. Over to you.
Okay. I will confess that I didn't read Octavia Butler's Kindred until the year 2000, 21 years after it was originally published. And though the book is set in 1976 with time travel back to pre-Civil War Maryland, it was so timely at the time for me. It felt so fresh. In historical fiction being published today, we often talk about dual timeline novels. But Kindred was one of the first dual timeline novels I ever read. The protagonist, Dana, is pulled back and forth between timelines. If you don't know this work, it is a work of science fiction, and the main character time travels. And I think that that time travel maneuver is both effective and devastating. It's effective because those of us who love history dream of being able to travel safely back in time to meet and get to know our ancestors. But it's devastating because Dana's visits are not the stuff of fantasies. Her visits to the past quickly turn violent, and she witnesses firsthand the difficulty of living as a Black woman in antebellum America. And Octavia Butler was one of the first Black women writers to write in the genre of science fiction. And when I read this book, I felt that my imagination was so enriched by the encounter. It opened all kinds of possibilities for me. In terms of what fiction could do when it came to chronicling the Black American experience. It wasn't so much that I was interested in writing science fiction, although I do dip into the waters of speculative fiction in my second novel, Balm, as much as I realized that there were no boundaries or limits to what I could do or write. All of the tools of narrative were at my disposal. I just had to learn them. There was also this quote I heard Butler give during an interview once. She said she chose a female protagonist because she didn't think she could realistically keep a Black man alive during those times. I was shocked by that statement and really disturbed, though I immediately understood what she meant. Antebellum America was a dangerous place for a black man. But if that were true, what was the converse? Was it easier for black women? Did black women have a certain advantage? I wasn't quite sure about that, but surely, I thought, there was something unique about the black female experience and perspective that could provide a unique insight into history. Thinking about Butler's statement has been part of what has compelled me to center my own stories around black female protagonists. So this book has been absolutely critical to me. After her sudden and an untimely death in 2006, Butler rose to the level of literary icon in the United States. More people discovered her work, more teachers taught her work, her lesser-known novels became more well-known. But I still recall that moment when I discovered Kindred in my own time and how I cherished each page and marveled at her unheralded creativity.
Ooh, it was right as at the same time.
That was pretty much right on the nose, perfect. Dolan. And what a wonderful, wonderful sentence to finish off. That was close. You did a fantastic job there. Mm-hmm. Both of you did. Wow, thank you so much for those pictures and for bringing these books to our attention. Tara, C. Russell Price sounds absolutely wonderful, and their writing is, as you have just demonstrated, so powerful. Yeah, I mean, it affected you reading it.
I mean, maybe because they're my best friend, yeah, you know, and I would do anything for C. Russell Price, but also I just know their struggle with getting queer poetry published.
Yeah.
And the fact that my alma mater is doing that, I'm just so proud. And I just get really emotional.
Yeah. No, I'm just so proud
of them, too. Like, I just hope we take this world by storm. I hope that their poetry collection is able to be published someday over here, too.
Like,
they deserve that. And I just think it's so much, it's time for Black artists, it's time for queer artists. It's our time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, I'm.
Well,
I'm going to be
seeking it out. You know, if it's a American press only, I'm gonna order it based on what you've said about their work, but also that reading.
You'll have to come to Chicago and we can have a party.
Well, that's a much better idea, isn't it? That's a much better idea. Shove this ordering it business. I'll just come over and get myself a copy. But thank you for telling us about it and for flagging it up. And Dolan, I absolutely loved your pitch. The fact that Kindred, you know, I know you read it 21 years after it was published, but the fact that it felt so fresh and timely to you then probably would for someone reading it now. And that it obviously had such a influence on you and your work and how it sort of helped shape what you've written is really great, you know, and that's so important that books do that for writers. And being one of the first black women to write in that genre as well is mm-hmm. huge, isn't it? And so important.
She's been hugely influential on a whole generation of writers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
Tara's putting her hand up like me? Me as well? I'll take, you know.
There was some exhibit, at this beautiful museum. Oh, I forget the name of it. Outside of L.A., the Hutchins something, and they had all of her works, her journals.
Oh, wow.
And I just walked around. You could touch her journals. And they blew them up on big... Oh, God, I can't remember. Hutchinson Library, something like that. I'll have to think about it. But it was... That exhibit changed my life. It really did.
Gosh, I mean, it sounds like a wonderful book, a powerful book. And as you say, it's great that she's now become an icon, even though she sort of passed away far too young, but people have and are discovering her, and she's being taught, and this is brilliant.
Oh, yes. And it's, you know, it's a really good read too. I mean, I was I got my copy off the shelf last night, and I found myself reading it all over again. It's a good read. She knew how to spin a yarn, so I highly recommend it to your listeners.
Well, I mean, both of these books sound absolutely fabulous. Both of them sound very important. I can't wait to get this poetry collection, Tara, that you have mentioned. Gosh, it's impossible to choose, really. But do you know what? Just based on the fact that it's been such an influence, I think I'm going to take Kindred. I'm going to take Kindred. Just pipped it. But I tell you what, based on that reading alone and just all your passion for C. Russell Price, I'm going to check them out.
Okay.
They sound absolutely fantastic. Good. And you're so right, though, Tara, about it is, it's got to be the time.
It's our time.
For queer poets. You know, this is the time, right? This is got, and we've got to be publishing people like C. Russell Price right. more widely.
Right.
We have to be. And it's
right.
it's fantastic that you've brought them to our
they
attention.
They should be a household name.
Absolutely. So. And hopefully they will be.
Oh
and you've
goodness.
Helped a little bit. Helped
the
a little bit towards that.
See, Russell and I will be having on our yacht in Lake Michigan, watching the fireworks in Chicago, toasting away to us. Please, Mama needs a house.
Yeah, Mama needs a house, please. Come on, get those orders in. And you can help Tara get a house by ordering Memphis, which is out now and it's published by John Murray and it's absolutely brilliant. And Take My Hand by Dolan Perkins Valdez is out on the 12th of May here in the UK, if you're listening to this before that. But you can pre-order it now if you want to. And it's published by Phoenix. What an absolute pleasure to spend this time with you both. Thank you so much for being here and joining us. And thank you for your passion, for your recommendations, and thank you for your two brilliant, brilliant novels, which I really, really, really enjoyed. And I have a little present. I can't give it to you, Dolan, because I haven't worked out how to give something through a screen yet, but I will send you one of these. We've got a book off tote bag.
Oh, nice.
Now, this one's for you, Tara.
Oh, my God.
Now, I notice you already have a very snazzy bag with you. So
I don't
this
care.
Is not gonna live
I
up
love all bags.
You can maybe take that to the
thank you so much.
To the bookshops or the records.
Oh,
I think
God.
It fits records, actually. So you
don't tell me
that.
This because I'm flying to Paris tomorrow. And now I have a carry-on bag for the records.
There
and,
we go.
And my life is complete. Thank you so much
it's like
for this.
I thought about it. It's like I thought about it.
Oh, my goodness.
What an absolute pleasure and a joy. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
It's an honor.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.